Welcome to the Rural Births podcast. This podcast was created to record and share stories from the many rural women who have birthed, to allow them to voice their experience and learn from them. I want rural women who are pregnant, planning to get pregnant, or entering their postpartum period to feel supported and know that, although care may be via distance, there are options. Thank you for listening. This podcast is produced on Yuin Country. We acknowledge the innate birthing wisdoms and traditions held by the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, the traditional custodians of this land. We remember the first women of this nation, the custodians of land and birth, who birthed on country in culture and tradition. Here, as we share in stories of birth, preconception, pregnancy, and postpartum experiences from remote, rural, and outer regional communities, may we remember and stand for the cultural significance of birth, women's business, and birthing on country. May we nurture and support women through this rite of passage as we hear of possibilities ignited and limitations created. May we share in the power of storytelling and memory as we listen and learn from these birth stories. And may we always remember the ancestral wisdoms belonging to the country these birth stories occur on today. This is part two of Rhea's story. Part one can be heard in episode 26, wherein Rhea shares her journey to conception and through prenatal care. Rhea is a mother, photographer, wife, and powerhouse self-advocate. We heard part of Rhea's story in episode 17 when I interviewed Rhea's wife, Claire, about her work as a rural home birth midwife. But we first heard from Rhea herself in part one, episode 26. Rhea epitomized strength. She shared how she maintained her strength through an assisted conception journey and through meeting with the restrictions placed upon birthing people in institutionalized birthing structures. Rhea reminded us all in episode 26 that you can say no, and that you can interrogate why practitioners are recommending different care pathways. In this episode, we hear Rhea's birth and postpartum story. She shares how she went into labour at home and that travelling in labour impacted her progress. She shares how she found breastfeeding support within her rural context and overcame supply difficulties through initially sourcing breast milk donations. Rhea is a great source of advice for rural women, reminding us all that although we're isolated, there are still many ways and means to source the care and support we need. Thank you so much for sharing your conception and prenatal care journey and moving through now to your birth. So
42 weeks plus three, did you have to leave the MGP program or were you still allowed to birth over 42 weeks at MGP?
No, I was still, I didn't lose my place with the MGP. I think it came up as a question. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if I raised it or whether Claire raised it. But I was assured it wasn't going to be an issue, so I let it go. It was fine.
That is very cool. I find that last minute change of direction, maybe like just because you're over 42 weeks, like if you're over and maybe there's other stuff, like let's get some at-risk factors that aren't maybe just a statistic. And it's a small shift in statistics as well. Someone else phrased it really well that like for it to be say a 50% increase, it's a 50% increase on a percentage that it is less than a percent. Like it's very small. And that's still a 50% increase. But when you get down to talking about what the actual numbers are, you can suddenly go, oh, well, am I okay with that number? It doesn't seem as big as when they said it was a 50% increase. Like it's all different.
Absolutely.
So that's awesome that Victoria has your back and is.
I don't know that it would be so reliably true in all MGP programs. I think there may have been an element of. Well, I don't know. I can't comment because I don't remember what conversation actually occurred around it, to be honest, and I haven't been again. I don't know anybody else
that it worked out.
But it did. And I think that, you know, I think there was a very strong suggestion that, well, no, I had said it outright, certainly at one point in my pregnancy, to my midwife and to the obstetrician that, you know, if I was put through core, I would give birth on the side of the road before I gave birth in the hospital. That was, you know, and I meant it. Claire got very nervous because I meant it. Look, at the 11th hour, you know, as we're getting to, I think it was sort of 38, 39, about 39 weeks, we finally were in a position where we might have been able to just about afford a private midwife for a home birth. So that we were trying to look into it. And the closest midwife was trying desperately to crowbar us in, but already had like four births or something around the same time. And it was just, and it just wasn't going to work. And I was really reluctant, even with my primary even with MGP, I was more than happy to birth with my primary midwife. In fact, I wanted her to come to my house, but I never told her that because she'd have had conniptions. Because she wouldn't have been able to. Let's just be clear. It wouldn't have been an option. But that would have worked for me. But I was dreading the thought of having to birth in hospital in the birth suites with not most of the other midwives. It sounds like I'm being personal, but I'm not. There were only two midwives that I felt comfortable with, and my primary midwife was one of them. And I was dreading the thought of having to give birth in hospital with somebody else. I didn't want to do it. I wanted a birth at home. And it got to the point where, you know, Claire was a big initiative. And of course she wanted me to birth at home as well, and I say this flippantly because it was never really an option, but I felt at one point like I respect women who choose to free birth, it's not for me, but I did feel at one point like I was the only woman in Australia who can't free birth because my wife is a midwife who's not endorsed to be at home birth. And the shit show that would fall out from that was just I couldn't think, you know, I just couldn't bear it. And we did have, you know, there were talks of, you know, do we have a cocktail party and that all our midwife friends just happen to be at when I give birth, you know, like all this stuff is going through my head. I was so desperate to be at home. So desperate to be at home. And we did think we had.
When you went into labor.
Pardon?
When you went into labor, did you give yourself a longer time then, like at home, delaying kind of going into hospital?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was never going to be anything else. We did think we had a home birth in midwife that was going to be able to turn up just right at the last minute. And then I'd been in labor for, this is a running joke at the moment. So I'm one of these women that'll say I was in labor for a couple of days. And then Claire goes, well, she was only in active labor for, you know, a day. And I go, it's funny how the ones not having the contractions think your labor's half as long as it actually is, isn't it? So I get it. I know the mechanics. I know what I know what labor and active labor and second stage and third stage are. I get it. But, you know, I was in labor all weekend, right? So we did think we had a home birth midwife that was gonna facilitate me birthing at home. And it just fell through right at the last minute. And it was fine. I suddenly took this breath and went, okay, I'm meant to have this baby in hospital, whether I want to or not, because, you know, Claire and I weren't going to do that at home without, you know, the endorsement, without the medications, without the just in case. It just wasn't going to happen. I mean, it wasn't an option. And I was able to take a breath and go, okay, in my everything for a reason scenario, I'm meant to give birth in hospital, whether I want to or not. And I'm now okay with it. So it was the morning, you know, I'd been in labor for, you know, like a full, I'm trying to think, I'll work it out now, but I've been in labor for a while. So it was the day he was actually born that morning I kind of went, okay, it was about 12 hours before he was born. But I said to Claire, very intentionally, your job is to keep me home until I'm about to push a baby out. We are not laboring in hospital. Your job is to keep me here. Good luck until I'm in transition. You know, I do not want to be anywhere else until then. And she did an amazing job at doing that. We had a very, very dear friend of ours come up as much to support Claire as me at that point, because I'd labored over two nights by then. And God bless her, poor Claire. She hadn't had any sleep either. So I spent all weekend laboring in the bath. We've got a big spa bath, and it's the perfect length to just be able to, every time I had a I just believe in us so much that if we just let go of the, you know, executive function thinking, that our bodies and our babies really do know what we need. So every time I had a contraction, I'd turn over in the bath on my forearms and sort of shins and lie there. Mm-hmm. And the water level was like right under my nostrils, just right there at my nostrils, which meant that for every single contraction, I had to relax and just breathe in and breathe out. So as the contraction built, I was breathing in. And as the contraction went, I breathed out. And I think we did a calm birth class while I was pregnant, and I do think that planted the seed, and I was doing the breathing exercises. And so I think that without even knowing that I'd internalized that, I think that's what happened. So every time the contraction stopped, I'd turn back over and I'd be chatting away in the bath and it was all fine. But every time I had a contraction, I was literally nose deep in the water, mm-hmm. which meant that, you know, I had these slow, easy breaths because I'd have got water up my nose and panicked if, you know, if I'd not been calm. So it worked really, really well. And then we transferred, Claire sort of called it. I was transitioning. So we hopped in the car and drove up to the hospital.
And what kind of signaled that moment to relocate?
I think Claire is pretty good at the external signs of progression of labor. I think she's got enough experience to recognize when things are getting to that point. I do remember getting out of the bath and really not liking my contractions very much anymore. It definitely ramped up a fair bit. And she's like, it's okay, you're transitioning. I never swore at her though. It was lovely.
Yeah.
We were swearing, loving. So I think for her it was, and I realized that I must have been really getting there, because as somebody was trying to give me food, I think B, our friend, or Claire had tried to give me some food that B had done, because I hadn't eaten anything. I didn't want to eat or drink. And I heard Claire saying, oh, can you make sure those towels go in the car? And I'm like, oh my God, she thinks we're having a baby on the side of the road. Oh, we're pretty close then. So she made sure there were towels in the car, because she could see that, you know, we'd sort of got to that point. But I hated the car ride. It was hellish. It was on par with the worst part of labor for me. And I quite enjoyed being in labor. I'm not somebody that hated labor. I thought it was great. It was intense, don't get me wrong.
Yeah. But you liked that space in the water, like it.
Yeah, it was suddenly, awesome.
Were you in the back of the car, like?
Yeah, a bit more I was in the back of the car. I tried to have the seatbelt on. I was on my hands and knees hanging over the back seat, and we're in a Prado, so the back seat is higher, so you feel every bounce on our country roads. And yeah. Oh my god, oh, it was horrible. But I only had two contractions in the car, so okay. My labor sort of, well, regressed and not stalled. That's the wrong word. It responded to the environment I was in, as we do, you know. Yeah. So. By the time I actually got into hospital and then, you know, walking into the birth suites, I had probably another, I don't know, 5 or 6 contractions. They started coming pretty heavy again then. But I didn't progress the way that we sort of expected me to. Mm-hmm. He wasn't born quite as quickly. And at one point, Claire got my midwife to do a vaginal examination. Well, obviously, you know, discussed it with me, but was sort of, I think she was a bit sort of, I thought we'd be further along than this. Something's, you know, got in the way. And it was the transfer. It was the, you know, yeah. I can't imagine how true rural remote women manage that in, you know, over an hour or 2 hours. That's not okay. No woman should have to be going through that. It was horrible enough, you know.
I think that's part of why I was so amenable to induction, was that I can't quite connect with that thought process anymore, but I know deep inside me that I was almost asking or almost agreeing and with the different things along the way, because I didn't want to have to face the drive. Yeah. I didn't know if we'd get in the car soon enough. I didn't know what it would be like to travel in labor. So I've got some work to do, you know, mentally through those things. And that's where I think doulas can come in really handy as well, like to have those big chats. Before having another baby, I know that there's just a few barriers that I need to push through and think about.
Like you said, they're planting the seed, you know, the big they, but that seed is being planted so early on. You know, my experience was that drive was awful. I hated it. And the fact that I only had 2 contractions, one of them was as soon as I got in the car, and I only had one other in that probably 35 minutes, you know, between the house and, you know, the hospital. It clearly affected me and my labour, pardon me.
So you got this final exam.
Yeah, and I was, you know, at that point I was only 6 centimeters with a swollen cervix that I'd started pushing on involuntarily at that point. And it was just, I had a cervical regression. You know, it happens. It happens when women are put under stress or their environment is screwed up while they're laboring. And that was a problem because I was already starting to feel like pushing because, you know, apparently the swollen cervix can create that sensation as well. And and they kind of left me to it. But Claire stayed with me. But I was told categorically that I had to get, you know, off my legs, and I needed to lie down on my side, and I needed to put a peanut ball between my legs. I needed to do anything that would help me change the position of bub and the pressure on my cervix to try and give it time to for the swelling to go down. Mm-hmm. And at that point, sort of, we'd been there for a little while, and that's the only other point of my labor that I truly hated, was that feeling of every contraction, I felt like I was fighting it instead of going with it. Yeah. And it was horrendous, absolutely horrendous. And then my beautiful, loving wife, who's an incredible midwife, I may have mentioned it, she is phenomenal and I adore her deeply, turns around and says to me, we might need to think about an epidural. You can. Oh, I have not gone through all this to walk out of here having had an epidural. Are you on a... It's not happening. So she's just going, look, you know, they serve a purpose. You know, I've got a strong feeling about epidurals, that they shouldn't be used routinely because they do have an effect on baby. They do have an effect on feeding. They do have an effect on outcomes, and there is a cascade associated with them. But I do understand they serve a purpose too. And they are clinically indicated at times. And that was what she said to me. She said, this is where we use them. You are not going to be able to birth this baby with a swollen cervix. And right now your cervix is woman.
Yeah.
So my midwife hadn't told her as she left the room, because probably because she didn't want that information out there. But Claire had seen her, she lip read her saying it to the other midwife, so she knew what had happened. Yeah. She knows too much too. And she's a secret. So I was adamant that, you know, come hell or high water, that I wasn't going to do that. And when the midwife came back in, she'd left us to it for about an hour, maybe a bit less, but around that. And I, God love peanut balls, because I've never liked them. I'm not bothered about them. But rolling that between my legs through my contractions was amazing. It was the only thing that made it bearable. And when my midwife came back in, Claire sort of said, you know, I think we need to do another check. Are you all right if we do another check? And I can see the midwife kind of going, there's no point checking right now. We all know what we're going to have to deal with, sort of thing. And then I sort of said, she's told me we're going to need an epidural. I am not having an epidural, you know, blah, blah, blah. Right? I'm still in this. It's not happening mode.
Yeah.
And Claire sort of said again, can we just check? Can we just check? So apparently my wife knows me really, really well. I knew that suggesting an epidural would make any last-ditch ability of my body to overcome this particular barrier manifest itself. And when I had another VE, my midwife's kind of gone, oh, you're fully with just an anterior lip, which I can push back. And then she's kind of clear, so like sat there all smug, like, ah, knew that would work. So apparently, you know, she got inside my head enough that I'd overcome the swollen cervix and almost fully dilated. And as my midwife's sort of going, oh, with an anterior lip, I can push back. All I'm lying there, still on my side, kind of going, can I push now or what? And as I said what, I've just gone, whoa! Like, that was it. It was all. So apparently my midwife had pushed back the lip at that point, and that was it. It was like, get up on your knees, do this, you know, and I just jumped up, and I think in like about three pushes or something, he was birthed, and I was still cracking jokes in, you know, between pushes. It was brilliant.
Wow.
It was great. I was the best. It was so good. Yeah. My midwives are just like, my God, they've never been at a labor like it. They loved watching the connection between me and Claire. Like, we just held hands and eye locked through every contraction. It was the most intensely connecting, amazing experience. I feel so blessed to have had that experience with her. And I think, you know, I think all couples should try and experience that and understand that if you're the birthing person's partner, you have a real role to play, even if it's silent, just to be there with them. And for me, that was the eye lock in through all my contractions. And yeah, so we had this amazing, loving energy. We had midwives in tears. I'm cracking jokes, pushing out the baby. So yeah, so apparently I've been told I pushed like a multi. I'm not quite sure what that means, but apparently I pushed like a multi. So yeah, it was amazing. It was really, really incredible. And just, I don't know, I couldn't have expected it. I couldn't have anticipated what any of it was going to feel like. Mm. I couldn't have anticipated the fact that I thought I was so well prepared, and I'm like this birth warrior, and I know all this stuff, and I've read all this stuff, and hands off my baby, and that first real contraction, where the hell's the cesarean at? I don't think I can do this.
And then you had the whole weekend of ice cream contractions.
Yeah. And the God bless the MC, because she talks about those stages and how, yeah, you know, each time it feels really hard, it's going to feel better soon. That's a crisis, and you'll get over it, and then you've basically acclimatized to that as the new normal, and then that feels easier again. And I think just having absorbed all that so much meant that, yeah, I just trusted it and went with it and didn't fight it. You know, breathed through it all and went through it all and experienced it all. And it's so strange. I don't remember any ring of fire. I do remember something I said as he was descending, where I was just like, what did I say? I think something along the lines of, you know, it's feeling a lot like he's going to come out my ass right now. I think Which is, you know, also perfectly normal. And then, oh no, it's all very vagina-centric now. I think the next
yeah, I think people will get you on that.
But I honestly didn't know that I'd birthed his head without them telling me. It was so strange. It was
wow.
This, yeah, I didn't realise. I'm just like, are they out? Are they there? You know, like, I don't know. I can't quite explain that. Can't quite explain it.
Mm. So
but I do think part of it was sort of the up and the downside of the midwife wife was she was so involved, obviously not as my midwife, but as my wife, and it's her baby too. She was always catching that baby. She was obviously involved in, you know, involved in the midwifery conversations around what was happening and how it was happening and all the rest of it, because you know, you can't just shut it off. But it meant that I was at, you know, sort of on my hands and knees hanging over the end of the bed. They were down the business end, mm-hmm. and nobody was actually up with me. And we've talked about it since, because Claire didn't realize this, and I think he gives her a pang of regret. But they were saying things to each other that I couldn't hear. So I was a little bit trying to listen, trying to concentrate, trying to, you know, so, you know, it was this sort of strange experience of feeling slightly disconnected, because there were conversations going on around me that I wasn't part of about me. Like, so, you know, and I find that really interesting, because as much of a woman centered, all about the woman, you know, practitioner that Claire is, that, you know, that can still happen to a woman in that space, that you can still get sidelined is too strong a word. It's not that, but you know, that right in that moment, sometimes you people don't realize that they're not including you in, you know, the comments or narrative that's going on around you, because she didn't know I couldn't hear what was being said.
It can probably speak to as well, like the useful kind of thing of having birth support people as well as your partner. Mm. I've kind of been a big fan of a multi-person birth space and spoken up about it to a lot of friends. Like I had a local friend come with Lloyd and I think that I just didn't want that where, like, even if Lloyd had needed to go to the toilet, I was like, well, at least someone's here. So they're down the business end and you're hanging over the bed. What do you remember most about the moment your son was born? Because you didn't know you were having a baby boy.
No, we didn't. I think Claire, obviously, because Claire caught him, so she knew he was a boy. And I think she may have told me as she was passing him up to me between my legs, pardon me, before I actually saw him. And I sort of, I picked him up. I had a big t-shirt on, so we were trying to get my t-shirt up and out the way so I could hold him to my chest. And I was sort of up on my knees, and suddenly, all of a sudden, I'm just like, wow, you know, my legs are actually aching a bit now. I feel like I need to move, but I'm just trying to get a handle on this really slippery creature that's just emerged from me, and I haven't been able to look at yet because he's just down there somewhere. And you know, it's just my memory of it is slightly frantic. It really is, because it's just like that's how it felt. I'm just like, I want to see, and I can't get to him. So that, you know, my hands were on this baby, but he was so slippery because, you know, he was 42 plus 3. There was mech. You know, there was always going to be mech because he's added a mature digestive system by then. So, you know, he was mech stained when he was born, and he did have some airway issues. So, you know, it didn't come without its own thing. But his head was born in his membranes. So apparently that's the only time anybody's seen an actual, like, mech due to trauma during birth is different to that maturity, you know, there's mech in the waters sort of thing. Okay. And the only time that's caused an issue with airways, apparently that baby was born with their head on call as well. So we don't know what it is, but
yeah, it's really.
But as he came up to me, I finally get a bit of a grip, you know, under him. I'm doing it as I'm talking to you. I'm just reliving it, and I'm just looking at him, and he's just looking at me, and we're just looking at each other. And I don't know what else was going on at that point. I've no idea. And then we're just staring at each other. And then I think Claire was trying to help me move my t-shirt. I'm sort of trying to pull him a bit close. And he sort of, he felt a bit floppy. And at this point then, so this is where things go a little bit sideways. At that point then, I realized there was some tension and some energy that I wasn't liking around me. And I sort of tuned into it. And I realized that, you know, I'm not sure if it was clear or my midwife is sort of coming around with a towel, trying to rub him up a bit. And I hear somebody saying something about, we're going to have to cut the cord. And, you know, none of those things were part of the plan. We were going to have delayed cord clamping. It was white. So he had had all his blood back, but it wasn't, you know, I'd have left it for, well, whatever, we'll get around to it. And then I hear Claire starting to say, you know, he's just having a bit of trouble with his breathing. And then my midwife comes over with a CPAP, a puffer mask. So I've still got him, but she's trying to, you know, sort of give him a bit of puff. Mm-hmm. And probably after that was when somebody had said, we need to cut the cord. He's going to need a bit more attention. And then he got taken over to the recess trolley. So, you know, it was everything about, I'm going to get emotional now. Everything about my pregnancy, labor and birth was just blissful. Like you couldn't imagine better. And then, you know, within, I think it was about 4 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes of him actually being born, he was taken over to the recess trolley. The pediatrician aspirated, so suctioned his airways. And he still had a really hard work of breathing. His chest and his tummy was sort of seesawing, which is horrible. And they put him on CPAP then. And he was on CPAP for about, I think it was 15 hours or 18 hours all up. I did know that, slipped my mind now. It was after I actually gave birth to him. And all I remember saying is, go with him, go with him, go with him. So my friend stayed with me and Claire went with him. And that was when things sort of went a bit sideways then. I was a bit stunned and I didn't have my baby with me and everything felt a bit surreal. And I hadn't had, you know, the breast crawl and the delayed cord and, you know, and the undisturbed 3 hours of, you can all stay out of my space now, I'm connecting with my baby. You know, it was all a bit sort of... it suddenly all felt a bit sort of like I was part of, I don't know, like a routine, something. There was something, I felt disconnected. I can understand why. I'd just given birth and my baby got taken away. But I was a bit stunned and felt a bit strange for a little while. And my placenta came away straight away, which I thought was good because, you know, I know that stress can sometimes cause a problem with it. But for me, it was almost like, all right, the baby's gone. We need this out and we need to go with them. Like it was like, boom, boom, boom. Like, so, he spent a little bit of time in special care after that. And the thing I have emotions that I haven't resolved around this. And I've got questions that I feel like I still don't have all the answers to. I understand that certainly what he had in terms of the CPAP was necessary. You know, we get that, but he was put on, they put an IV line in to give him IV antibiotics. And as it turned out, there was no sign of infection, but those tests don't come back straight away. So they do it as a, you know, a precautionary measure. And they gave him a glucose line, or gave him a glucose drip through it as a sort of keeping the line open and as a just in case. And that I've got a problem with, because then it took 5 days and formula in the end to be able to get him off the glucose drip for me to bring him home. And I could have probably brought him home within 2 days if that hadn't been the case. So we then had a lot of breastfeeding issues, because instead of a baby being attached to me, I still wasn't sleeping, you know, in a hospital bed, stressed as hell, you know, watching. And I got told I wasn't allowed to handle him because they hadn't got the line in very securely and they were worried about it being dislodged. So it was, that week was a really hard week. It suddenly went totally sideways, and it was so weird being so informed and so self-advocating about me and my baby all the way through my pregnancy, that suddenly when he was out of me, I didn't have that information. I didn't know anything about anything. I hadn't read up on any of those possibilities. They weren't going to happen. So then I was a good patient because I just did what I was told.
Yeah.
Because I trusted the system and the doctors. And I don't think anybody's, again, there's no intentional harm, but I don't think their priorities were my priorities. And, you know, it's something that Claire and I still work through a little bit because she was obviously with him and saw what happened and understands and validates the CPAP, but has her own opinions about whether he needed the glucose and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, yeah. It's kind of, it's hard, and it's hard looking back on it because it wasn't the way we thought it was going to go. But, you know, people could argue, but he needed it. And, you know, maybe he did need it all. And I have a very healthy, happy baby. It took us months of persevering with breastfeeding, and we using SNS lines, and I've been on medication for supply, and we used donor milk for a few months to sort of get him up and strong and ahead of the curve enough while my and all the things. And now he's a very, very healthy 98th centile height kickboxing, you know, boob monster. So, you know, it's all been worth it. It's all gone fine.
And on that kind of lactation support, was that something that you were able to get because of being with Claire, or was that something you guys needed to seek elsewhere?
We actually had, hello. Sorry, speaking of boob monster, it's that time. So we tried a few different avenues. We had an LCE kind of group class at the hospital that I was discharged with him from. But that didn't sort of identify any issues. But there were issues, and Claire was really concerned that he had some ties and wasn't feeding well. But nobody else seemed to think he wasn't feeding well, which was a really difficult position for me to be in, because it just feels like, why are you looking for problems? We finally got him home. But she was right. He wasn't feeding well. And we did need to address it. So we went through an LC closer to home then, who was wonderful. But we realized that no, his ties were probably having an impact, and not that LCs tend to make recommendations around it, but we decided to have his ties revised. And he just wasn't putting on weight very well. And, you know, and it was sort of every week it was, oh yeah, but he only had the ties done a week ago, so he won't be better yet. And it was only a fortnight to go, so he won't be better yet. And, oh, they should have only just revised, so, you know, now it'll start getting better. And oh, this medication won't kick in until now, so now it'll start getting better. And every week his weight gain wasn't very good, but there was always a reason for it. And then we sort of got to this point where I went, I think it was 12 weeks, I finally saw how skinny he was and sort of went, there's been a reason for it every week, but we're at 12 weeks and he hasn't put on a kilo since birth. Like, that's not okay. And you know, our stomachs dropped and we realized that we just hadn't seen what was in front of us. You know, for all the help we were being offered and given and support we were being given, we needed to do something else. So we actually found another LC through the ABA. So we got, you know, we hired a breast pump because I'd been pumping anyway, so I'm a bit confused about the details there. We already had the breast pump. So I was pumping 3 hourly for 11 weeks and continued to do it for quite a long time afterwards. And we realized it just wasn't enough. I wasn't giving him enough milk. So we found an LC who's actually a GP as well through the ABA, and she's amazing. Everyone needs one of her. She's a unicorn, and she I've said this a few times today, she totally met me where I was at. You know, she named it. He wasn't getting enough. We needed something else. He was going to need formula or donor milk. We tried formula. I had an anxiety attack buying it. I hated every second of it. And then he had a big reaction to it. So that ruled that out. And we started looking for, that was only in the interim while Claire was trying to source some donor milk, which is easier said than done, especially when you live 2 hours from Melbourne, because that's the downside, or 3 hours sometimes from where milk is available in Melbourne. So there's an amazing Facebook group called Human Milk for Human Babies. If you have an oversupply, please get on there and donate it to people, because there's so many of us that need it that by the time you get on there, it's gone. So Claire was spending hours finding finding donor milk, and we'd go down every couple of weeks. And then a beautiful friend of mine that I met through my mum group up here sort of went, I've got a freezer full. I'm putting it in the bath. I don't know what to do with it all. I've got a massive oversupply. Would you like some? Hell yes, thank you. And it was perfectly timed with COVID restricting everything and shutting everything down and making us very reluctant to want to go and get biological products that we still needed from beautiful, beautiful strangers, but, you know, people we don't know nonetheless. So, yeah, this very beautiful friend of mine up here offered to be our donor, and we did that for a couple of months. And it just gradually needed less and less and less of it, and he got stronger and stronger. You know, create the proper supply and demand that he should have been doing early on, and now he's just a boob monster.
And would he take that donor milk from a bottle, or did you do like the line thing where you
put we did both. So he usually had a bottle, but I actually feel like what changed his suck patterning and made him a stronger feeder was actually we used the supply line a couple of times, and it was like the penny just dropped for him.
Yeah.
Because I do think the bottle, the EBM bottle, it sort of created its own problems in there then, because the boob was so much harder. Yeah. But when we did the supply line with the donor milk, it was like, oh, hang on. I can have all the smell and comfort and love and sleep and the milk from the boobs. Gotcha. And like, oh, darling. Oh, darling. What's the matter? Yeah, so, yeah. And then we were just, it just got better and better and better after that.
So kind of to sum up and finish up, having given birth the first time, what kind of are your feelings on rural birthing now? Like, do you view it as full of limitation, or is it possibilities that open up? And what do you think people rurally need that they maybe can't get at the moment?
I say this knowing that my wife is now a privately practicing midwife, so it's a caveat, okay? I think that we're limited in our options for good quality, evidence-based, gold standard maternity care. I think that we're subject to greater fearfulness and conservative just-in-case practice because we're further from tertiary centres, because we're further from, you know, the backups, just in case they're needed. We're not sort of seeing birth as normal first. We're looking at how to interfere with it as a just in case, and not realizing the irony of that is that it causes more problems. And for me, if we had our time again, regardless of our financial situation, I would beg, borrow, or steal the money for a home birth and have a privately, like my own, not private, like public funded would be great. Make the MGP models home birth programs, do that. There's no reason not to, but I would be looking for my own midwife to meet me in the care that I'm looking for on my journey and to support me to birth at home. And my regret is that we didn't feel that finding the money was an option early on enough to actually make it an option. And, you know, there's no publicly funded home birth services in this area. And, you know, as it turns out, Claire's now the only one who's really available.
She's traveled all the way out from where you guys are to, like, Wagga Wagga. Like, she is sought with a very large radius.
Yes, and thankfully she's prepared to travel. So, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that's my takeaway is, you know, we make compromises. They're either going to be financially or in the type of care that you know you can access. And
yeah,
I think I wish I'd understood that better first time around.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good takeaway, that remembering there are still options. You might have a few extra hurdles to jump, or you might have to face some difficult things, like you said, beg, borrow, steal the money to get a home birth midwife. But meeting your needs is really important. And yeah, I think when you were describing your birth, you can kind of look at that car trip as what you didn't want. And that's a future kind of, like, if you were to birth again, directions would be laid somewhat differently.
Absolutely. Yeah, very much.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for giving us Mum and letting her talk about her birth story. And yeah, thank you for sharing all the way through from conception to postpartum as well. I think you've given really your open-heartedness with your stories is really helpful, like I said, all the way from conception through to what you're sharing about lactation as well. There's a lot of very accessible advice there, and I really appreciate that you spent the time with me.
Thank you again to Rhea for sharing her rural conception, prenatal, birth and postpartum stories. We really appreciate her openness and generosity within sharing her own story. If you would like to share your rural birth story or your experience as a rural birthing practitioner, please get in touch via Instagram at rural_births or send me an email, ruralbirths@gmail.com. And once again, thank you for listening.